It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Barrett. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, it's our next installment of Curious Wisconsin. This week, we explore a mystery in Ripon and search for the town's mystery cave.
But first, if you open your New York Times to the opinion section today, you may have noticed an unusual contributor to the paper, Vladimir Putin.
The Russian president took his message on Syria directly to us, the American people. He's calling on the U.S. to avoid using force against Syria. He says if the U.S. and Russia can work together on this issue, it could pave the way to cooperation on other things.
Joining us now to talk about that piece and where relations between the two countries go from here is Lisa Baglione. She's professor and chair of political science at St. Joseph's University. Lisa, welcome to Central Time.
Hi.
Well, tell us about this op-ed. Why do you think that Putin chose now to write it?
Well, the president was in a difficult situation. He wanted to act, and it was clear that the public was not favoring a strike against Syria, and that the Congress wasn't supporting him either. And so this was an opening for Putin to, in a sense, appeal over the head of Obama to the American public, and also to try to appeal to the world public to try to stop any kind of violent action against Syria, strike against Syria, and achieve for Russia some positive outcomes, which makes he's increased his prestige, and also is helping his ally Syria avoid a bloody confrontation.
Now, you could see this piece, I think, in a couple of ways. You could see it as an aggressive move that's sort of designed to show up the Obama administration, or you could see it as maybe a move designed to give the U.S. a diplomatic exit strategy on Syria. How do you read it?
Well, if you look at this and say, does Putin have ulterior motives, I would say certainly. And some of them are not in line with U.S. strategic interests. But I do think that what he's done here is give the U.S. an opening, give the U.S. a lifeline. Getting authorization for a strike from Congress was not and is not guaranteed for the president. Now, the president has said he would act even without that authorization because if he feels that this was so important for U.S. national security interests. But the public isn't behind him either. And he gave a good speech the other night, at least to his supporters in Congress. They were more reacted to it positively. But still, it's a tough sell. So what Putin does is gives Obama the opportunity to move forward with a diplomatic solution, which can also achieve American foreign policy goals. And those include strengthening the Chemical Weapons Convention, putting the UN back into the picture, and in addition, showing the Muslim world we're very close to this 9/11 anniversary, showing the Muslim world that the U.S. is not simply willing to use force against Muslim populations. So all of these are really important, I think. And in that way, Russia and the United States' strategic interests at times do overlap.
And yet there are critical sections, certainly, of this op-ed piece, the first part of it being that the U.S. needs to abide by United Nations law, otherwise the United Nations is undermined and world safety is undermined. And then at the end of the piece, he moves toward looking at American exceptionalism and pointing a critical finger at that and saying that the U.S. should not think of itself as exceptional. It's a very strong way to end the piece. How should the Obama administration digest those two critiques?
I guess I would advocate that the Obama administration think about this as the Kennedy administration approached something during the Cuban Missile Crisis, in which when Khrushchev wrote, first he wrote a telegram to the administration providing an out to the crisis, and then later there was a follow-up communication which was much harsher, and the administration chose to ignore what it didn't like, and I think the administration should ignore what it doesn't like. Putin's trying to make some points too, score some points. I would ignore it. These Putin also says that in one place that the relationship between Obama and Putin reveals a growing trust. Well, we know that's not true, but we should grab what is worthy and move forward with it. Putin is trying to also make appeals and win an audience and win points, but that doesn't. I don't think that should. Keep us from pursuing what ultimately, and this is my opinion, works best for the country and actually for the administration at this point, because the administration doesn't have the support of the public. The administration is going to have to fight a huge battle with Congress and really go all out to win the support of even those who normally are its advocates. And this fight will weaken Obama. And I do believe that Putin has a point that even though it's ironic that it's coming from him, he's not exactly an advocate of international law and international organization. But this administration actually is typically and has been from the beginning one that talks about the importance of strengthening international institutions. So I would say that the president and his administration should move forward ignoring those negatives and seeing that as just the price of Putin's posturing.
Well, even if you see the piece as, you know, a benign diplomatic sally, there's still a bone of contention embedded in all of this in that Putin goes so far as to say that the chemical weapons were used by the opposition in Syria and not the Syrian government. Does that paint this whole op-ed in a different light?
No, I mean, as I looked at it, I thought that Putin, in that op-ed, he makes some worthy points, and he puts forth some half-truths or distortions. I don't think that that's surprising from President Putin. That's not surprising. But what is a positive is that the outcome can be that Syria, which has an enormous stockpile of chemical weapons, gets them under international control. This happens without the United States virtually unilaterally, but, you know, the French will come along and some others will come along, but using force without the support of the UN, of the international community, and frankly, the American public. And, you know, it's very interesting that Putin makes that point that that in the United States, we typically expect the Congress to agree and the people to agree. But it's not there. And I think that shouldn't, the administration should not underestimate how important it is to have that support.
Lisa, not that it necessarily matters, but do you think that Vladimir Putin actually wrote this?
I would doubt it. I would doubt it.
Who would write it for him?
Well, he's going to have a large circle of advisors that would be helping him on this. And I'm sure Sergei Lavrov, the foreign minister, would be involved. And I'm sure, you know, some of these points he can make. But I would think that this comes from a committee, and it's very well crafted, and it very much speaks to Americans, like you said, and it was politically, from our perspective, in terms of trying to reach to the American public, it's not going to play well here that he is critical of American exceptionalism. That, in the president's speech, is exactly what he needed to try to reach our public. So this tells us that that President Putin was not simply trying to talk to the United States, but he is making an important statement to the world, and many of these points are going to resonate with the rest of the world, and particularly with the Muslim world.
How do we see the Obama administration reacting so far to this, and how do you expect them to react?
Well, I think the president reacted well. I mean, when you consider that this was a last-minute proposal planned just before his big speech that was going to ask for the use of force, and then the president backed down from asking for the authorization for the use of force, but he's keeping that in his pocket. I think the administration has done a good job in saying we'll pursue this, but we will continue to consider the use of force if it is necessary. Because in the end, what the administration wants, I mean, the administration needs to, because of the red line comment, it needs to take a stand on the chemical weapons use, and it has strategic interest in doing that. And Putin's plan or the diplomatic possibility allows us to achieve that goal without force. And if that's possible, then great. And again, it will only strengthen the Chemical Weapons Convention as well as international organizations, which is something that this president and his administration have said for a long time they want to do.
Well, Lisa, thank you so much for being here today.
You're welcome. It was my pleasure.
We've been talking to Lisa Baglioni, professor and chair of political science at St. Joseph's University in Philadelphia.
Coming up next, we'll go on the hunt for Ripon's Mystery Cave in our Curious Wisconsin segment.
You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
It's time for Curious Wisconsin now, and this week we head to Ripon, Wisconsin, to try and find out what might be hiding deep below the town's downtown. And we're putting the call out to you right now, too. If you have an idea for Curious Wisconsin, something you've been wondering about here in the Badger State, you can let us know on our Facebook page, and we'll try to find the answer for you. You can also call our hotline. It's 855-683-5422. That's 855-683-5422.
Years ago, a search for something called the Ripon Mystery Cave got underway, and of course, we love a good mystery, so we called up Craig Teabun to help us out.
Craig is the executive director of Ripon Main Street Incorporated, and Craig, welcome to the show.
Hey, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So give us some of the background here. If you could tell us about the Breadbasket Bakery and how that launched this mystery.
Yeah, well, I came to Ripon back in 1992, and almost from that first day, store owners and history buffs, they were all mentioning that there was an underground cave below Ripon. And so we started to ask some questions and talk with building owners and found out that it was probably, there was an entrance beneath the old Breadbasket Bakery. So when, unfortunately, there was a fire in that building, I think in 1999, and the bakery closed, which then gave us an opportunity to do some exploring. And we were dealing with years of folklore, and what we found was very similar to what old-timers had been talking about.
And before we get into how you got digging in there, what was the human history of this the underground passage? What were the rumors and the folklore you heard about it?
Well, there's been rumors that it was used for underground railroad. Which some of our local historians have disputed, because they've always mentioned that fugitive slaves probably would have went up the coast of Lake Michigan rather than cutting through all of the counties and the territories that may or may not have been friendly to fugitive slaves. There were other rumors that this was a place used during Prohibition and a place where illegal gambling and illegal drinking took place. So there were a few of those kinds of things, and one of the rumors was that, you know, this was below the basement of this building, and that there was a dome large enough to turn a team of oxen around. Hmm. And what we've found leads to believe that folklore is credible.
So tell us what you found when you first went down there and how you actually got at it.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Well, we ended up working with the Wisconsin Speleological Society, the WSS, and just started exploring in this basement by drilling test holes with concrete drills. And we found a void below part of the basement. So knocked out the floor and started digging, and we found a stone that's laid up, so it looks very much like a well, and then the other side, the other half of this hole that we found is dolomite. It's like a granite cliff, and we just kept on digging down and down and down. But unfortunately, we had to stop before we could find that actual cavern that was large enough to turn a team of oxen around, because the business ended up going into the building, and there was some health concerns with was removing all of that debris. But we did find some geological formations, and we did find a little side cavern, and but there's still a lot of debris that can be removed from the hole.
So now what? You can't get in through that hypothetical entrance. Is there a search for other tunnels that might lead into this?
Well, over the years, there's been some construction in and about this area. And so anytime there's a major construction problem with digging, construction project with digging, we monitor the site to see if anything is uncovered. Unfortunately, the business that went into this building recently closed. You know, there's always a lot of turnover or turnover in downtowns, and so the building is vacant, and this might be another opportunity to restart the search. We did shoot a short video that shows some of the formations, and so I don't know. I guess it could be a crapshoot, a 50-50 crapshoot, but it seems like we have found enough evidence at least to warrant picking this up again, but we also need some financial backers to do it.
Well, I mean, it sounds really interesting, and there's a lot of mystery there, but is anyone worried that there might be this yawning chasm underneath downtown Ripon?
You know, we never even entered into that discussion. We just... I think if we find some sort of cavern system, I believe that the number is there's several million people go beneath the ground every year and tour caves. So we looked at it more that this could also be a tourism boon for us. And who knows? I think being able to get further into this geological formation, and then seeing is there any evidence that would point in the direction of the Underground Railroad. That could certainly be another tourist type attraction for our community.
When you talk to people in the downtown area, people in Ripon, are they pretty excited to solve this mystery?
As time goes by, it was more the old timers that would talk about this. So, unfortunately, a lot of the people that we were dealing with were in their 60s, 70s, and 80s, and now another decade has gone by since we first started this project. So, we're losing a lot of those resources that we'd first tapped into.
Well, what's next? I mean, you said you've got to raise some more money, but do you have a planned excavation so far? If you get that money,
I think it would be more teamwork to bring in some experts rather than relying on volunteers to do this. So we're the hole is at least 17, 18 feet below the basement floor, so we're probably 20 feet, 20 plus feet below the surface of the surface of the ground. And there's things that we just don't know about. We need better assistance with making sure it's healthy air and that kind of stuff. You know, last thing we want is to make the news for a tragedy rather than making it for something that could be cool.
Speaking of which, Craig, were you able to go down there with the members of the Speleological Society as far as you could get?
Yeah. Went down, and so they were members of the WSS were able to point out floatstone formations and different types of rock that was down there. So I shot a little bit of a video. We didn't have iPhones 10 years ago, but took a small video camera down and shot some footage, and we put that onto YouTube.
What was it like being way down under your town there? What did it feel like?
You know, it was a little claustrophobic, and being at the bottom of that cave, anybody who's seen Silence of the Lambs, that's what it was like.
You're really selling us on it, Craig.
Not exactly where you want to have your Prohibition era drinking party, if you ask me.
Right. I mean, I don't know. It's a cool thing, but yeah, it was a dirty thing to certainly, because we had to dig the whole thing out by hand.
Wow.
So. a very muddy place to work.
Greg, thank you so much for being with us today. And if you solve this anymore, we'll check it out.
Absolutely. Sounds great.
That was Craig Timon, Executive Director of Ripon Main Street Incorporated. I think we got to get the Wisconsin Speleological Society on the show sometime, too. That sounds like a fun thing to talk about.
Yeah, for sure. And don't forget, if you've got an idea for Curious Wisconsin, let us know what your question is, and we'll try to find out the answer for you. You can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, as we get ready for week two of the NFL season, we'll hear from a guest chef who has some tasty tailgate recipes for the next Packer or Badger game.
We'll also talk to a guest who says technology is changing the way our minds work, and it's a change for the better.
Also, how Wisconsin became a great biking state, despite having only a few months of the year of really great biking weather.
And our news guy Noah Ovchinsky will be here to recap the state's top news stories. That's coming up tomorrow on Central Time. And coming up after the news, we'll talk with a guest who says we all too often attempt to hide our ignorance, and in so many cases, we'd be better off coming off clean. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, a look at the politics of food. We'll talk about the ways we eat, drink, and vote.
First, here's a thing that happens to me all the time behind the scenes here at WPR. We're talking about ideas for our show. Somebody might reference an article by so-and-so or this new book everybody's heard of, but maybe I haven't heard of it. So, do I own up and admit my ignorance, maybe look stupid in front of our producers? Or do I just nod and smile and fake my way through it?
Our next guest has an answer. Leah Hager-Cohen is with us. She's a novelist and author of I Don't Know, in praise of admitting ignorance, even when you shouldn't. Leah, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Well, you had a pretty painful and personal experience with admitting ignorance in college. What happened?
Yeah, I was in journalism school. It was my first week of journalism school, and I didn't understand a phrase the professor was using when he instructed us to look at part of an article. He said, look at the nut graph, and I thought it meant some kind of graph, like a pie chart or a Venn diagram or something. So I was anxiously paging through the article, unable to find what section he wanted us to turn to. And only later did I learn that nut graph refers to the paragraph near the beginning of an article that tells you what the story is all about. But I was far too ashamed to just raise my hand and say, I don't know that phrase. Can you help me?
We've all been in a situation like that, I think, or most of us. Why is it so hard to admit it for you or for anyone?
Well, I think, you know, at the first level, we're afraid of feeling shame and of losing face. I think beneath that, there's the fear that in losing face, we might be ostracized from the group we want to have a connection with. So I think, you know, underneath, it's about fear of losing connection.
And is that the case? I mean, do we lose connection when we don't know something?
Right. Well, what I, you know, discovered through the research that I did and the interviews I conducted in writing this book is that really connection is more often lost when we put our energy into faking it. And when we do own up, you know, we might experience a moment of embarrassment, a sort of, you know, a blush rising to our faces. But in fact, much more intimate and authentic connections can happen when we're just being upfront about what we don't know.
Is part of the problem not with us or with me, say the person who is afraid to say, I don't know, but maybe the way it's presented by the other person, like kind of a snobbishness, of course you've heard blah, blah, or that assumption, is it coming from them and not from us?
Absolutely, that's a big piece of it. But I have, as I've become more sensitized to this issue, I have noticed, I've caught myself perpetuating some of that unintentionally. You know, I'm not trying to exclude others or be snobbish, but I notice sometimes I make an assumption, oh, of course you've heard of, you know, this book, this author, this theory. So I have tried to work on this on both fronts, you know, both owning up to what I don't know, but trying to take care that I'm not assuming others know what I'm making reference to.
So there has been a lot of talk lately, both on this show and in lots of publications, about an epidemic of cheating in college and education in general. And, you know, I wonder if part of it is that, especially when you're a student, it seems so hard to be the one who doesn't get it, to raise your hand and say, I don't know what you're talking about. And I wonder if you think there's something we could do to change the culture in education that would be okay to be, you know, I don't know, more ignorant.
Right. Well, I think you're right. It's hard socially for a student. It's hard emotionally for a student. But there are also sometimes very real consequences when students speak up and say, I don't know. Sometimes there's an adverse effect on a student's grade, or there's a classroom culture in which the teacher actually actively shames that student for confessing ignorance. So I think the more we can re-envision classroom environments along the lines of encouraging experimentation and sometimes failure and, you know, honest expressions of ignorance when we don't get something, the more we see those as leading us to real honest inquiry and real honest intellectual growth, I think the healthier our classrooms will be.
We asked people about whether they're willing to say, I don't know, on the Central Time Facebook page. Sarah writes, when she encounters somebody talking about a TV show, say, or a book she hasn't read, she writes, I admit ignorance because that gives the other person an opportunity to be a fan and share what they love about the thing they're referencing. So she sounds like she embraces it as an opportunity. What do you think about that?
Yeah, well, it sounds like she's describing a situation in which not only can she have the opportunity to learn from the person she's in conversation with, but that person gets to express more deeply and thoroughly what it is about the TV show or the book that excites them so much. So already it sounds like more animated and real conversation is going on.
So what exactly is at stake, you know, when we pretend that we know something that we don't actually know? Is there a real cost?
I think there is a real cost, both in terms of cutting ourselves off from real authentic connection with others, because when we're putting energy into faking it, how authentic can our connection with others be? But there's also a cost within ourselves. There's a rupture of the self when we're dishonest with others and with ourselves. And I think that really exacerbates shame. When we know we're trying to get by in a conversation through dishonesty, through dissembling, through nodding and pretending we know what's going on, I think the cost is both external and internal.
You mentioned looking at research. Do we have a sense of when this starts? Is this a grown-up thing or do kids do it too?
Kids do it too, and it's interesting. There's been, anthropologists and psychologists have done studies. Some of these studies show that kids are much more willing to be upfront about what they don't know, that they feel, there's less at risk, there's less social cost, and I think that is to a certain extent true. At the same time, we see this behavior in very young children who cotton on quickly to the idea that those who have power and authority are often those in possession of knowledge, or at least in possession of a kind of demeanor where they present themselves as being certain. And so even really quite young children can ape that behavior.
Do you think there's a difference between men and women when it comes to being willing to admit ignorance, or is it just kind of an equal opportunity issue?
Well, I think it probably is an equal opportunity issue, but I think in the case of women, there's an extra social layer that can make it even more complex, which is that for a very long time historically, and it's thankfully becoming less true today, but the historical weight and residue is with us. Women have been told that men are not attracted to smart women, and to play down your intelligence so that you can make everyone feel more comfortable and even so that you can get a mate.
So we shouldn't do that, right? I'm guessing.
Right.
Let's be clear on that.
I'm not espousing that. I'm saying that's some of the weight that we have to get out from under.
So maybe it is a little harder for women because some of that is still out there. I mean, that's a bad idea, as we just heard. But I'm sure that, a lot of women can probably relate to a time where maybe they felt more comfortable playing dumb.
Exactly. So it's almost, there's a kind of reverse energy for women. Instead of feeling pressure to fake knowledge, sometimes women who do understand something or who do know the reference might find ourselves playing dumb because we've picked up on overt or subtle signals that this is just, this is the nice way for a woman to behave.
Leah, I got to ask. The subtitle of your book is In Praise of Admitting Ignorance. The subtitle is Except When You Shouldn't. When should you not admit ignorance?
Well, if we're saying I don't know as a way of avoiding responsibility and burying our heads in the sand, that is certainly something I would not advocate. I think if we're saying I don't know as a way of making ourselves vulnerable and opening ourselves up toward to more understanding and more true connections with others, that's great. That's what I'm in favor of. But I'm not saying there aren't times when we have a responsibility to find out and to share what we do know, share our knowledge, and speak up loud and clearly about it.
So it's, I don't know, please tell me more, not I don't know and I don't care.
Exactly. I don't know becomes it's the first step in opening oneself and being receptive to greater understanding.
So now we know what to do when we don't want to look dumb in front of the producers.
Uh-huh.
Okay. All right. Well, Leah, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
That was Leah Hager-Cohen. Her new book is called I Don't Know, In Praise of Admitting Ignorance.
Coming up, an expert on food, nutrition, and public policy joins us to talk about the politics of food in the United States.
You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The politics surrounding what and how much we eat can take you down a rabbit hole. Food politics can be controversial and confusing.
So, why not explore food politics with cartoons? With one image, you can absorb complicated conceptual information.
And that's what our next guest says. Her new book is An Illustrated Guide to Food Politics.
You can join in this conversation. What do you think about our food policy here in the United States? What's wrong with the U.S. food system, or what's right? What do you think we should change, or what's working and we should keep it the way it is? You can call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or send an email, talk@WPR.org.
Marion Nessel joins us now. She is the author of Eat, Drink, Vote, An Illustrated Guide to Food Politics. She's a professor in the Department of Nutrition, Food Studies, and Public Health, and a professor of sociology at New York University. Marion, welcome to the show.
Oh, glad to be here.
Well, let's start with a cartoon on the cover of your book. It's a piece of pizza shown with the caption, New Congressional School Lunch Food Pyramid. Why did you choose this image for the book's cover?
Well, there were a couple of reasons. One is because I think it's really funny, and it was such a commentary on how Congress has gotten involved in micromanaging the Department of Agriculture's school lunch rules. So it was sort of an instantaneous explanation of why food is political, which a lot of people really don't understand. And then the colors matched with the design.
Well, thank you for being honest with us.
The design was a big issue in this book.
Sure. But there's also a story that goes along with that piece of pizza that you tell toward the beginning of your book about how Congress did get involved in pizza and school lunches. Tell us that story, would you?
Yeah, to me it was just a shocking story because the Department of Agriculture had worked with the Institute of Medicine, a think tank in Washington, which produced a couple of really big reports on how to make school lunches healthier and set up nutrition and food standards for the school lunches. And the Department of Agriculture did that, and when it issued its rules, one of the things the USDA was trying to do was to encourage kids to try different kinds of vegetables. So they wanted to restrict the number of times that potatoes would be served during the week. So a potato wouldn't be the only vegetable. That was one. The other one was that they had made an exception for tomato paste so that the tomato paste that was put on pizza counted as a vegetable serving, even though it was at a very, very small volume. And they wanted to raise the volume to make the tomato sauce be the same as all the other vegetables, have the same volume requirements. And so they put those rules through little thinking that it would require Congress to get involved. And Congress, in a spending bill, put in a couple of provisions saying you aren't going to do either one of those things.
Well,
and micromanage the Department of Agriculture's rules. And this was done at the request of the companies that make pizza for school lunches. And they wanted to be able to say, see, these are vegetable servings. And also the main potato growers
didn't want
any restrictions on potatoes.
Yeah, the details of that story, wasn't it something like to count as a vegetable, you needed half a cup of tomato sauce or more. And then, you know, people fought back and said, then we have soggy pizza. And then you got
right.
embedded in all the politics that you talk about there. And now a pizza is a vegetable.
Now, you know, pizza serving counts as a vegetable.
And then on the other hand.
By an act of Congress.
Right, by an act of Congress, which is good news to me. But I don't know if that's going to help my health any or my children's health. So. How do you think food got to be so political in America?
Oh, the money, because of the money that's in it. It's $1 trillion a year business. And any time, I mean, it really wasn't a problem until obesity became a problem. And once obesity became an issue, particularly childhood obesity, the nutrition messages had to change. The nutrition messages for decades were eat more. And eat a variety of foods, and they had to change to eat less and choose some foods rather than others because you want healthier ones and don't eat some kinds of foods. And the minute that happened, the companies that made products that were on the don't eat side or the eat less side didn't like it because their bottom lines were affected. So it's just as simple as that.
Well, it's an interesting, you know, tangle there, because on the one hand, you have what you're talking about, the money-making interests involved in food production and the food that we eat. And then you've also got this strand of individualism in America where we say, you know, hands off government, I want to decide what I eat, and we don't want the government to have a say. So how do you untangle some of that when you're talking to consumers?
Well, I try to explain the government is already deeply involved in what people eat, and that the food system that we have now did not emerge by accident. People made this food system, and it's changed enormously in the last 25 or 30 years in parallel with rising rates of obesity. The best example that I can give of why personal responsibility doesn't always work in food choice is the research that's now been done on large portions. There's now a substantial body of research that indicates that if you give a person a large portion of food, that person, no matter how self-controlled, will eat more calories from that portion. Will take in more calories and will underestimate the number of calories taken from a large portion much more than from a smaller portion. So large portions alone are an inducer of eating behavior that most people can't control, even if they want to.
So there's a lot involved here, including psychology. And as far as the government goes, doesn't the government have regulations to help promote healthy foods as well?
Well, it has some regulations. It's got labels on food products. It's got dietary guidelines that are issued every 5 years and that are about as political as anything in food could possibly be, for exactly the reason that I talked about. If a dietary guidelines committee chose to have as a guideline, well, since we're talking about water today in Wisconsin, let's talk about water. Suppose the guideline was instead of drink more water, it was drink water instead of soda. Then soda companies would be very upset.
Right, and then what happens? I mean, then they get Congress gets backlash,
then they go to Congress and say we don't want the government doing this, and Congress acts. That's why the business about the school lunch regulations was so shocking to me, because it meant that a private company could go and lobby Congress, and Congress is busy and doesn't pay attention to the details in spending bills. These bills are enormous, and no single individual in Congress could possibly know everything that's in one of those bills. either the spending bill or the farm bill or any of those bills. They're too big and too complicated. So it's easy to sneak things in without anybody thinking about them, and I think that's what happened here. Or anybody thinking about the implication of Congress micromanaging school lunch standards, which, you know, from my standpoint as a public health nutritionist, makes no sense at all. They don't know anything about nutrition standards.
There's a section in your book about kids' food and how it's a genre unto itself, that certain foods are created to be kids' foods and then kids want to eat that food. But you beg the question, do kids really want to eat that food, or do they want to eat it because they're told they want to eat it?
Well, it's hard to disentangle that. I don't have small children anymore, but my friends who do tell me that they have 2 or 3 year olds who have never been to McDonald's, have never watched television because they're those kinds of parents and they don't have television in the house. They've never talked about McDonald's. They've never been to McDonald's. And yet when they drive down a street, their 2 or 3 year old recognizes McDonald's and says, "I want to go eat there." Hmm. And they say, "Well, how do you know that you want to eat there?" "Well, because the food's good." "How do you know the food is good?" "Because it is." I mean, this is brilliant marketing. Brilliant marketing, and billions of dollars are spent on trying to get kids to do 3 things. To recognize brands of food like McDonald's, and kids recognize McDonald's everywhere. To ask their parents for the foods, pester their parents is what it's called. And then the third thing is the one that worries me the most, and that is they try to get kids to think that those kinds of foods that are advertised to them, foods in funny shapes and colors in packages with cartoons on them, are foods that are meant for kids, and that's what kids are supposed to be eating. They're not supposed to be eating the boring foods that their parents are eating. They're supposed to be eating kids' foods, foods made right for them, and that they know more about what they're supposed to be eating than their parents do.
Marian, is this kind of a uniquely American problem, or is this sort of a global food problem now in a lot of developed countries?
Well, it's everywhere and increasing. It's much, much less prominent in countries that have rules and regulations about marketing. But in countries that don't, marketing is very prominent. And most of the American food companies, the big ones, because sales in the United States are relatively flat, have moved their marketing overseas. And our marketing, particularly in the wildly, rapidly emerging economies of China, India, and so forth. I mean, that's where it's happening, and with exactly the predictable results that as populations in these countries get a little bit more money and can afford to buy these very attractive, heavily advertised products, they're putting on weight, too.
Well, we're talking right now with Marian Nestle. She is the author of the book Eat, Drink, Vote, An Illustrated Guide to Food Politics. She's a professor in the Department of Nutrition, Food Studies, and Public Health at New York University.
And we want to hear from you. You can join the discussion at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Would you want to see laws on marketing of foods to kids? Do you want that restricted? Would you like to see better regulations, a change in regulations on what is and isn't healthy food? How about those big soda bans that they were working on in New York City? Any other changes you'd like to see, or success stories of the American food system? Call 800-642-123 or send an email, talk@WPR.org.
That's 1-800-642-1234. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.